There's a word, a piece of financial jargon you probably hear a lot. Liquidity. It's basically what it sounds like. How easily what you own or owe can be turned into cash. It's not an accident that it sounds an awful lot like something we rely on every day. Water. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of August 8th, 2014. Today's show is all about being liquid. In the financial system, your own pocket, or at the very building block of life itself. We're taking a special look today at water, how we use it, waste it, and what it costs us. Whether you're trying to pay a water bill in Detroit or worried about hurricanes in the Gulf Coast, that's all coming up later in the show. As always, you can talk to us at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. But now let's get going. Here's your Economic Week in 20 seconds.
Initial jobless claims coming in at 302,000.
Everyone had been expecting Walgreens to be the latest American company to go for one of these tax inversion deals, and it now looks as though they're not.
A report this morning claims a Russian gang is holding a massive list of stolen online records.
There was a report out today from two bank regulators, the Federal Reserve and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, that basically said, yeah, that too-big-to-fail thing, Wall Street is still totally going to hose us.
Hose us. The biggest banks in the U.S., they were made to write living wills so that in the event of another crisis, we don't all go down with them. You probably don't need me to remind you that they had a massive, liquidity crisis. But this week, they basically flunked their checkups with federal regulators. Patty Hirsch is a senior editor at Marketplace and the host of the Whiteboard video series, and he's here to help me explain what's going on. Hi, Patty.
Hello, Lizzie.
So federal regulators came to these big banks and said, hey, your living wills, they are not credible.
Not credible.
Not credible sounds like a pretty rough judgment. What does that mean?
It's incredible. They're incredible. Well, so the agencies have to agree to call the plans not credible, like the regulatory agencies have to say that the plans are not credible in order to trigger this legal requirement that forces the banks to submit a revised plan. So that's why you've got this kind of weird, archaic language. Like if they'd said, oh, these living wills are incredible, then that would be a good thing. But not credible is not a good thing.
But they didn't. So they said they're not credible. And now what does that mean the banks have to do?
Well, that's a good question, because banks weren't expecting this kind of pushback. They've been submitting these living wills for the last several years, like 3 years in a row, starting in 2012. And they've kept on falling short, but nobody's really sort of pushed back on them. And this time, the regulators have pushed back really hard. So I think that's taken the banks a little bit by surprise. So the banks are really going to have to step up and do something here. They're actually going to have to commit to the spirit and the letter of this kind of regulation or this directive by the regulatory agencies and actually fix this stuff. Otherwise, the regulatory agencies could actually take some fairly drastic steps.
We're on the other side of the financial crisis now, and I think a lot of Americans are like, whew, all right, we made it. But hey, wait a minute. If these plans, which were out there in case the government had to wind down a bank, that's what these living wills are for anyway. If the government says, hey, these are not so hot, should people feel safe? Because this seems like the kind of thing that might make me scratch my head.
Yeah, well, I think the public should be out there scratching their heads like crazy, and not just because of bed bugs in the subway. The fact is that...
Oh, Patty.
Sorry.
That only happens here in New York. That was not fair.
But the fact is, we're talking about too big to fail here. I mean, this is what we're talking about. After the financial crisis, everybody said, oh, Dodd-Frank, this new regulation is going to come in. It's going to be this whole kind of raft of regulations and rules. They're going to make sure that we have a financial system that's not going to be at risk whenever one bank fails. And these tests and these living wills show that that is manifestly not the case. We are still in a situation where we have banks that are too big to fail, that are going to require some kind of government help if they actually run into trouble. And that's a really bad situation for us to be in. And it's absolutely the reverse of where we wanted to be following Dodd-Frank.
We're talking about the biggest banks in the country, some 11 banks here, and that includes the big guys like JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs. And I want to bring up this concept of moral hazard. Mm. You know, the idea that is hanging out there, I think, in a lot of people's minds, that the government rescued the banks once and that they might just step in and do it again. Do you think that is in the back of the minds of the people running these banks and maybe in the back of the minds of the regulators as well, that
they might have to do this again if we come to some terrifying economic meltdown point.
I think it's in the back of everybody's minds that that is a possibility. And what the regulators are trying to do is to get to a place where it's as remote a possibility as possible. Now, I think that for the most part, the people who are running the banks absolutely don't want to be in a position where they're a bank that's considered too big to fail. They'd really rather not be. And I don't think they're indulging in moral hazard.
So they got to sell stuff?
Well, they got to sell stuff. But I think here's the thing. You know, if you are a line manager at a bank, if you're like running the CLO division or the mortgage-backed security division or whatever it is, you are under immense pressure, all right, to make sure that you make money running that division. And if that means that you're going to push the edge of the envelope a bit in order to get stuff done, then you might say to yourself, well, worst comes to worst and the whole thing comes crashing down, maybe this is right in the back of your head, then, well, maybe, you know, the government will step in to bail us out because we're too important. So I think that, yes, that is in the back of everyone's mind, in some ways in a negative way, in some ways in a positive way. But in the back of the minds of people who are actually creating and selling these securities, it's a really bad thing to think that the banks might actually get bailed out by the government because they're just too damned important.
So what happens next?
Well, next, the banks have to make a move. They've got to do something in order to make sure that the regulators are satisfied. And what they might actually do is start changing their legal structures to make them less complex and to show that they can actually produce reliable information about the kinds of risks that they're exposed to. And there's this other clause that they could sort of get their heads around, which would actually mollify the regulators to some extent, which is amending a bunch of derivatives contracts to make them easier to bring through bankruptcy.
Oh, yes, we all remember those. Yeah. The financial weapons of mass destruction, Warren Buffett called them.
Exactly. You want to make those things as easy as possible to deal with in bankruptcy, because the one thing that everybody fears most of all is that when things are really, really opaque, because opaqueness makes people scared, then people start running for the hills. And whenever people start running for the hills and refusing to lend and refusing to use the banks, that's when you've got a big systemic issue, and that's when banks start to melt down and the system starts to fail. So if they can mollify the regulators by dealing with those things, then maybe the regulators won't get all upset with them and start thinking about breaking them up. Because that's really the big hammer at the end of this. If they fail to produce a good living will over the next couple of years, then the regulators will start to step in and say, well, maybe you have to divest some assets, maybe sell some divisions. We might shut you out of certain areas of operation, or we may even just break you up.
Patty Hirsch, senior editor at Marketplace and host of the Whiteboard video series. Thanks a lot, Patty.
Always a pleasure, Lizzie. Thank you.
For more on whether big banks are any safer, plus the other big stories, we rounded up some friends to go have brunch. We are out having brunch at the Cornerstone Tavern on 2nd Avenue in New York, and I have got Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine with me and Joe Wiesenthal from Business Insider. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I want to talk about Wall Street and the big banks, because it kind of blows my mind that here we are, they've submitted these living wills that the government said, yeah, no, that's not going to work for us. And also we have this record fine that is being discussed, a record settlement being discussed between Bank of America and the government as well. I kind of feel like are we watching a rerun? What is going on here? It's 2014.
I think I never understood the concept of a living will. I mean, I understand the concept, which is that you have this plan in place so that if your bank is failing, you can be more organized about. But I never like understood how it was really supposed to work in practice, because you never really know like how the crisis is going to strike and where
right.
there's going to be a run and where there's not going to be liquidity.
Right.
And the idea that these banks that are so large could ever not be too big to fail kind of seems laughable.
Like, yeah, I think it's
there's just
another
no way they're not too big to fail, no matter what kind of what they put in writing.
It's another way of them being like, promise, it's not going to happen again. Like,
right.
trust us.
Okay,
right.
But to be a little counterintuitive, is there a role that consumers have to play? I mean, how much do we enable this, right? If you're saying these banks are so huge, do we have to step back and stop banking at them?
That is, like, such a huge question. Like, philosophically, we're, like, all so complicit in everything that happened, as far as I'm concerned. Like, yeah, I mean, Joe's
I feel
skeptical.
Like, no, I mean, I just feel like, one, that it's really unlikely to move the needle at all. And I also kind of wonder whether ultimately the risk would just be transferred in a different way. I mean, we had a Great Depression before there were no mega banks, and instead we just had thousands of bank failures, really tiny ones.
That's an excellent point.
So I don't, you know, I like the spirit, and I certainly think that you know, shifting around where we put our money, I'm skeptical will really somewhere, there'll always be financial crises
right
in the future.
Well, I would just like to say I can give a free advertisement to Schwab because they reimburse all my ATM fees.
Oh, I'm yes. No. I also use Schwab for the same reason. Yeah, it's great. It's great.
I am curious about the buying power, not of us. I mean, we're all in our 30s. We're adults, theoretically. Jessica, you have spent some time with Lorde, the singer, pop sensation. You've been to Lollapalooza. I want to know what millennials, and actually not even millennials, people younger than that are thinking, doing, buying. How are they doing this? Because I have a sense that it's very, very different than what we were doing.
You know, it's funny. I think that's what everybody wants to know right now. I was just visiting a friend at Bloomberg, and he introduced me to their millennials reporter. Like, they have a dedicated millennials reporter. So that's kind of fascinating. And, wow. I mean, Lorde is not – I mean, is she a millennial? She's 17 years old. I mean, I just watched her perform and was, like, in front of thousands of people and was just kind of like, 17 years old, 17 years – I couldn't, like, get over it. It was pretty amazing. But I will tell you that millennials are buying a lot of very short shorts right now. Very short shorts in
so
floral prints.
You're bullish on short shorts.
I'm bullish on short shorts and Rebecca Minkoff handbags. Right, right.
Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine, Joe Weisenthal from Business Insider. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up next on Marketplace Weekend, a special in-depth look at water, how it and the lack of it are shaping our lives and businesses.
I've never seen the water in this lake this low. The customers are asking me, how long do I think that we'll be open? I can't answer that question because I don't know.
Have a drink. We'll be right back. If you drive a car in Southern California, you'll be reminded over and over of one thing, the drought. There are billboards telling people to be on the lookout for water wasters. The electronic signs used for amber alerts and road hazard warnings have defaulted to drought warnings. Farming economists estimate some $5 billion will be lost this year because of the dry conditions. And that doesn't count the losses to places like car washes. So we wanted to put the costs of the drought in context, and we sent producer John Sepulveda out to talk to a small business owner. Hi, John.
Hi, Lizzie.
Tell us where you went and who you talked to.
So there's this private lake in Corona, California. It's about 60 or so miles east of Los Angeles, and this lake sells fishing access. So if you don't have a fishing permit, you could just show up at the lake, pay about $75 for 3 days worth of fishing. And lots of families come here. They bring their camping gear. They have picnics on the shore. And this lake is about as big as 100 football fields or so.
So small, but not too small.
Exactly. So anyways, I show up. I meet the manager. I tell him I'm looking to talk about the drought. And right away, he waves me over.
Come here and I'll show you.
What's his name?
Jimmy Davis. They call him JD. He's a big, tall guy, trucker cap, fishing t-shirt, Marlboro Reds kind of man. And he's taking me to a trailer that serves as an office here.
You see this picture here?
In this picture, boaters are waving towards the camera and families are on the banks fishing. It's a real idyllic scene.
You see how far back into the trees the water goes?
There is a lot of water and it goes high into the trees, maybe about 9 or 10 feet.
Now, come around here and I'm going to show you something.
And so at this point, we start walking away from the trailer.
And where are you guys going?
He's taking me to the edge of the water, and it's a lot longer walk than it was when that picture was taken about 5 or 6 years ago, because this lake looks like a big, green, algae-filled puddle. And Lizzie, this is what the drought in California sounds like.
What is that sound?
These are shells. They are freshwater clam shells, and there are thousands of them all around, dried up on the shore. This is the carcass of the freshwater lake here in Corona, California.
The deepest part of the lake right now is 8 feet. And when this is full, it's about 22, 23 feet.
So it's down almost about 17 feet, somewhere in there.
Yeah, and the thing about it is right now we had water coming in back here in the back to kind of hold the level the right where it's at, but they cut the water off. Now, if the water keeps going down, the shad and crappie will start dying. When that happens, everything in this lake's going to die.
So for our listeners maybe in New York or somewhere else, what are shad and...
Shad is a bait fish. Crappie is a fish that a lot of people go after because they're one of the best-eaten fish that you can get, okay?
So when those fish go, you're saying everything else in this lake goes, what happens to your business at that point?
We'll close the doors. We'll close the doors. Actually, it's up in the air as to how long this lake will stay open.
How much money would this private lake lose if you were to shut the doors?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And JD, how long have you been working here?
Been working for this company for 17 years.
What would you do?
Well, I'd go on Social Security disability. Okay? Simple as that.
Have you ever seen the water this low? Have you ever seen the conditions this bad?
I've never seen the water in this lake this low. The customers are asking me how long do I think that we'll be open? I can't answer that question because I don't know, okay? If I start seeing fish dying...
And at this point, Lizzie, he's trying to say it's over. Once these fish are dead, there's no oxygen left in the lake, meaning the lake is dead.
John, this is a private lake. There are only a handful of these things left in California. How did you find this place?
You know, my brother used to come up here to fish in the late 1990s, and I used to drive him. For me, I grew up in Southern California, and it's weird to think that this lake that has weathered drought since 1934 could just disappear like this. I mean, the loss of revenue is awful. We just heard JD say it's going to be about several hundred thousand dollars a year for this family. But I think about my brother even. He's going to take his kids by here someday, and he's going to say, hey, you see that big dry hole? Well, I used to fish there. And it's a conversation I wouldn't even have imagined 5 years ago.
Producer John Sepulveda joined us from the Marketplace studio in Los Angeles. Thanks, John.
Anytime, Lizzie.
You just heard how the Western drought could force the closure of a small business in Southern California. But drought conditions aren't just local. There is significant drought on every inhabitable continent. And that got us wondering what big companies are doing about that drought, say, company like Coca-Cola.
Well, so Coca-Cola, a little over a decade ago in India, got quite a shock when some local farmers near one of its bottling plants started complaining about its water use.
That's Polita Clark. She's the environment correspondent for the Financial Times, and she recently wrote a series called A World Without Water. And she says that moment when Indian farmers complained about Coca-Cola's water usage spurred the company to start conserving and preserving water. In England, Coca-Cola took what had essentially become an industrial drainage ditch and turned it back into a river.
Because they wanted to improve the quality of water that was flowing through it. And so it's quite interesting. I mean, there was a relationship with Coca-Cola in as much as some of the sugar beet that they grow in the UK to sweeten the drinks that they make here. Some of that's grown along the river, and fertilizer runoff from that sugar beet can be a problem for the river. It is nonetheless quite unusual for a company to spend that sort of money on such an odd project just to really try to improve the quality of water in around its operations.
You have some startling numbers in the stories that you have put together, including that companies have spent some $84 billion over the last 3 years on water reclamation projects, improving conservation, etc. Why are they doing this? What's in it for them?
Well, there's a range of different reasons. I mean, sometimes they do it because of physical water shortages. You know, sometimes these newer environmental regulations are forcing this to happen. In other cases, a changing climate can lead to some quite significant expenditures. In other cases, companies are either getting ahead of or responding to environmental regulations that are basically saying we can no longer have you just discharging wastewater that's fairly toxic or polluted back into a river or a stream. They're spending a huge amount of money collectively on that sort of plant and equipment.
I think a lot of people view water as something perhaps endless or boundless. They turn on the tap. They maybe don't think twice about it. And yet you have written this series of stories with the heading A World Without Water. When you started reporting these stories, did it change your view about the amount of water we consume as a planet?
I think what it did drive home to me was what we really mean when we talk about a global water crisis. This is something that, you know, the World Bank, the UN, and other bodies have been warning about for 20 years or more. And what really has become evident to me is that, we're talking about a global water mismanagement crisis. In other words, water is really poorly distributed. You know, if you and I were in charge, we wouldn't create a world in which something like, 60% of world water supplies are in only sort of 9 or 10 countries. And even within those countries, it's really poorly distributed. And then it's long been taken for granted. It's been mismanaged. It's been polluted. It's been overallocated. And so what we're seeing in country after country is growing competition between the two biggest users of water. Number one, farmers, who globally use about 70% of water. And number two, industry, companies, who use around a fifth of fresh water supplies. And so it's that growing competition between those two groups that is really becoming more and more intense in a lot of places. And that's something that a number of companies are really focusing on. In fact, Google's really interesting. You know, the head of their data centers operations said, I think it was 2009, in fact, they recognized that there's been a huge amount of focus on climate change and carbon emissions, and that was all fine. But once the public started realizing how crucial and how strained water supplies were, then data centers, for example, which can use hundreds of thousands of gallons a day, depending on their size, they're really going to be coming under the spotlight. And water is going to be the next big elephant in the room, according to Google, for data center operators. So, you know, I think companies are generally starting to realize that if they don't try to grapple with this problem, it's something that's going to become much more serious for them in future.
There was something that a Nestle executive told you that made my eyebrows go up when I read your story, which was, we're going to run out of water long before we run out of oil. And that threw this into relief in a way that, frankly, I don't think I knew.
Yeah, I mean, that was Peter Brabeck, the chairman of Nestle. And I mean, I guess it's a contested view, but, you know, you can see why in certain parts of the world it's possible that this could happen. Although, I don't know. I mean, one gets into a lot of difficult arguments about peak oil and peak water. But certainly one thing that's interesting is that, you know, we've had this debate about peak oil, you know, for when the world is really likely to seriously run out of affordable oil supplies. We've had that debate for many years, but now people are starting to talk about peak water. And that's a relatively new phenomenon, and it's one I think that we're going to be hearing a lot more about.
If you are going about your day in different countries around the world, how do you think people will start to feel the impact of either a global water shortage or how different countries, different companies start to manage that response to a global water shortage?
One of the reasons that we don't look at the global water crisis in quite the same way as we do with global warming and climate change is because, to a large extent, we are talking about a series of local dilemmas rather than an absolutely global situation.
I have just one last question for you. In your story, you talk about the almost unconscious way we often think about water, where you might not even be able to recall your first memory of it. I'm wondering if you can.
Gosh, I think my first memory of water was probably playing in the bath and dreading having my hair washed probably is another very close second on that.
Polita Clark, environment correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We've been talking about how people and businesses use water. Some groups look at drought and see a way to make money. One of them is the Las Vegas Global Economic Alliance. Tom Skanke is its president and CEO. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You have this new public-private water partnership. Tell me about that and explain what it is.
So the Water Center of Excellence, which is housed here in Las Vegas, is the first time that in our state's history where we have brought the private sector and the public sector together. And what this really is a unique partnership of taking all of the research and all of the technology that our community has done over the past 30 years, house that under one center of excellence, and then turn that into an economic development and commercialization opportunity that has never existed here for us.
I mean, I think of Vegas as, frankly, a tourism place and a place where, you know, there's been a big housing economy. You're saying that this is potentially a new economic revenue stream for the area?
Absolutely. Most people know Las Vegas was one of the most hard-hit communities in the country during the Great Recession. This community was demoralized. We had an economy of development and tourism. And I refer to that as kind of a codependency because we needed one to have the other and vice versa. When we went through the recession, neither one of those two industries did extremely well. So we went, as a nation, we went through a great reset. But as a region and as a community, the Southern Nevada area went through a great reset. We realized about 3 years ago that we could no longer rely upon these two industries going forward to be the only two economic engines in our state. So we've created new partnerships that have never existed before. We've brought organizations together that historically had been competitors and put them under one umbrella and have tried to change the way the world looks at Las Vegas beyond the boulevard to let people know that there's a lot more going on here in the tech industry. Take all of that technological knowledge, all of the research knowledge, and then the Southern Nevada Water Authority, which is the application knowledge. This is a whole new industry for us, and we're promoting it. We went to the International Water Week in Singapore just a couple of months ago and had great results. We signed up two clients in the first day and probably put together another 20 opportunities for Southern Nevada and the Water Center of Excellence going forward. So we're very proud of the work, and we think the future of this Center of Excellence is very bright.
When you look around the globe at other places that are experiencing drought, do you see kind of a drought market opening up for your group?
Oh, good question. Yeah, I do, actually. And this is a whole new marketplace that I don't think has ever been looked at or fully inspected properly. There is drought all over the planet, right? And these types of conversations are happening all over the world. I believe that we are at the front end of a global conversation of, one, water purity and conservation, but also water sustainability. Water resources is becoming a global conversation. You look at the strategic advantage that companies and industries have where there is a reliable water resource. Go back just 3 or 4 years and look at the state of Texas when they were talking. Think about this, the Rio Grande River drying up, right? You go to the Midwest and you'd have conversations with people in Nebraska about the Ogallala Aquifer becoming almost financially infeasible to drill any deeper because the water is so expensive at the level where they are drilling. It's a very valuable commodity. In fact, some people have written and speculated that the next war in this world will actually be around water, right? Because it is such a valuable commodity. It is a limited resource.
But is there any moral discomfort that comes from making money off of drought?
Moral discomfort. Wow. You know, I don't think so. I think that if I can help a neighboring state solve a an issue or a crisis around water, then I'm doing my job, right? But I think that if my region has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in that research or that technology, then I think I should be compensated, right? I mean, that's what capitalism is about, right? That's what our country is built on, is we can help other nations, but we should be paid for the work that we're doing. I mean, I don't think that these research professors and the engineers at the Water Authority should go without being compensated. I think that we should take their experience, their knowledge and understanding, package that and sell it and help the rest of the world. That, to me, that just makes sense as an entrepreneur, as a businessman, and as an American. And I think we'll be a leader in several conversations for water in the future.
Tom Skanke, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
And that brings us to the weekend number. The number is 10, or 15 if you're feeling really bullish. That's how many years the ratings agency Fitch says Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Tucson have before water supply issues start hurting economic growth. Lake Mead, home of the Hoover Dam, helps supply all three cities with water. It's now 100 feet lower than it was in the year 2000. Just ahead, which debts keep you up at night? We'll hear your stories and get advice from the LA Times' David Lazarus.
Debt collectors can be very aggressive, and these guys know what they're doing. They've tried every possible trick in the book, and they know what works and what doesn't. They know they're catching you at a very vulnerable point in your life.
It's coming up on Marketplace Weekend from APM. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech. So let's get out of the studio and into real life.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
There were space invaders, there was asteroids, and then there was Troy.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
I gather you want to change my social life, right? Let's go with that.
Yes, I want to change whatever life outside of work you have, at least when it comes to paying for stuff and splitting the check.
Okay.
So for the last decade or so, there have been lots of experiments in the mobile payment space, right? You remember that little wand you would wave at the pump at the gas station?
Oh, yeah.
You could pay stuff, or you could pay with that Google Wallet, you have iTunes. But there's been some new innovation happening that makes things easier on the sort of the customer side of things, no matter where you're buying stuff and how you're doing it.
So these are the ads I see on the subway for sending money back and forth, yes?
Yes. These are the ads. You've probably seen the PayPal ads. There's also a company called Venmo. Now, it's interesting to note, Venmo is owned by a company called Battelle that was recently bought by PayPal, which might tell you a little bit about how popular this space is becoming.
I downloaded this app on my phone. I'm mildly terrified. I'm old. I'm not that good at this.
You're not old, and you're very good at the internet. Come on.
We're going to try it out?
Yeah. Like any good millennial, I have no cash on me, but I would love it if you would buy me some ice cream.
So I'm going to spot you some ice cream at the ice cream truck up
there. Yeah, why not? Is that okay? Shocker.
I guess.
Shocker, I know.
Fine.
Okay.
I will buy you an ice cream, Ben.
Yes.
Will you get me a cookie crunch, man?
Cookie crunch?
Yeah.
Okay, can we get a cookie crunch cone? And also, can I get a chocolate dip cone?
Thank you.
Ooh, sorry.
Oh, my God, that looks amazing.
Here,
I'm giving
amazing.
You the money. You can hand it because I don't have enough free hands. You're welcome.
Thank you for all this paper money.
You're welcome for all the paper money.
Oh,
my God,
this
is so good. So now that we had that exciting snack, you owe me some money.
So I'm going into Venmo right now. I've signed up for the app. I've input my credit card. I've also input my bank account.
The idea with this app is that you can find your friends, you can send them some money, you can split the check or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's right.
Say we were roommates and we bought a couch together at IKEA, you can send me a couple hundred bucks for the couch?
Yeah, and actually, what's really common these days is, like, small transactions. You know, you and I were in a cab, we just bought some ice cream. I'm going to pay you right now. I'm going to pay you $7.
Wait, you're going to pay me for all of it?
I'm going to pay for yours, too, because, you know, why not?
That is so nice of you,
Ben. I'm a nice guy. I've got your name in here. You and I are friends on Venmo.
Okay, we're friends, right?
So now it's asking me, what's it for? So I could say all kinds of different things. I could say payola. I could say...
You could say because your voice is loud and we share offices next to one another?
Yes, I could say because we're both very loud. I'm going to pay you.
I am a quiet little mouse.
So I'm going to put down here, ice cream awesome. And I'm going to click pay. So I just sent you $7. I said what it was for. And I made that public. So what's really interesting about this is that there's a social aspect to it, right? I just sent you.
Ooh!
You got it?
Benjamin
Did you get it?
J paid a new user ice cream. Awesome.
A new user. I like
That's
your
me.
Name is hidden. And it's really interesting. You can look here and you can see what other people are doing. You can see other people sending each other money. I actually saw one of our cohorts, Sabri Benashour, paid someone an amount of money for a charity, and they thanked him for it in the comment section.
My little brothers are buying pizza.
Are they buying pizza? Pizza, and pizza.
And beer. Yeah, that's about right. They're dudes in their
20s. Three pizzas and beer. All right. So this is what's interesting, right? There's this social aspect.
It tells a story.
It tells a story.
With all these notations, though, someone could see all these transactions. That makes me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, and it certainly could make a lot of people uncomfortable. You can see how much you've paid someone. You can see what you've paid them for, potentially. But what people seem to really like about the app is the same thing. They really like the social aspect of this. And what Venmo and other companies like it think is that this kind of thing drives engagement. It keeps you using the app. And the app itself is really convenient. And, you know, I think it's getting more and more users all the time. It was bought for $26 million this past year.
This was all very precious and cute with the ice cream and the emojis. But
yes.
Is this a real shift in the way we do business and use money in the U.S.?
Well, I think it can be, right? What's really interesting is that here in the U.S., we have not really been on the cutting edge of this kind of technology and this kind of way to pay each other very, very easily. There are other places where this is getting really interesting. So in Africa, for instance, there's a company called M-Pesa that's actually owned by wireless carriers in countries like Kenya, Tanzania, and it's an insanely popular way for people to trade small transactions, for giving each other money for bills, for rent, for dinner that they shared the other night. It's getting more and more popular there, in part because there's less financial infrastructure.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Speaking of apps, do you have marketplaces yet? No? We'll pick it up in the iTunes or Google Play stores. I talked about liquidity at the top of the show, and being deep in debt can be the opposite of being liquid. You're trapped, you can't get out. This week, we asked our community to think about debt. We've been collecting your stories on the street, on MarketplaceWeekend.org, and on Twitter, at MarketplaceWKND, about those debts that keep you up at night.
I have a lot of debt. My name is Jen Hitchcock. I don't feel like it was frivolous spending, but it just kind of happens. You know, you're behind 1 month, and then
my engine blew up on a car a month ago, so I had to put in a new engine and had to put it on a credit card. My name is Thomas. All right, what else you want to know about debt?
My name is Ale. In life, I always think you're always going to owe somebody or something out there, a business, a credit card. You're always going to have to pay something back. I think it's stressful, and, you know, they bug you to pay it, and you don't have the money, and that gets annoying.
I have a lot of debt. My name is Devin Davis. I'm 25, and I'm broke. I owe my mother $8,200. I owe $3,500 on one credit card and $2,900 on another credit card. I also have a $600 ticket, and I just got my car towed, so I had to pay $315 to get that out. I also have a $161 parking ticket that was on my car in the tow yard. And I also owe my best friends $90. So it's hard.
As many as 1 in 3 Americans with debt, about 77 million people, are so far behind on their payments that they've gone to collections. We've turned to David Lazarus for help. He's a consumer columnist for the LA Times. Hi, David.
Hi, Lizzie.
We just heard some stories about people's debt, and I was really struck by this figure that came out. 1 in 3 Americans with debt that has been placed in collections. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it means one of several different options. For example, let's say you owe money for something you bought at a department store. The department store might have thrown in the towel and written it off as a default. They also might have thrown in the towel and written off the thing and then sold it to a debt buyer. Or they might be using an in-house or third-party collection agency to come after you and try and recover as much as they can. The bottom line, however, is you owe money, and if you don't pay, there will be severe financial consequences.
It also sounds like there are severe emotional and psychological consequences. I mean, the idea of debts that keep you up at night, that make you wonder about what you can spend on your children, your food, all of those things, debt feels like a weight.
Being indebted is like wearing shackles or like wearing one of those cartoon ball and chains. And that can be not just a financial obligation, but an emotional or intellectual obligation as well, because it's hanging over you. And it's coloring virtually every decision you're going to be making in your life, whether it is, shall I go out tonight? Or can I get some new clothes for the kid? Or am I going to have trouble paying the rent? And the fact that the consequences of not paying your debts can be so profound. For example, if your credit score takes a hammering, well, any future borrowing you're doing is going to be at a much higher interest rate if you can get the loan. And that, too, is going to have repercussions. Moreover, if you get a black mark on your credit score, it can take about 7 years to get that thing off. So this is one of those bad gifts that keeps giving.
I think a lot of people, if they are starting to get a collections call or scary bills coming through the mail, their gut instinct is to hide. Help us fight that.
It's true, because the debt collectors can be very aggressive, and these guys know what they're doing. They've tried every possible trick in the book, and they know what works and what doesn't. They know they're catching you at a very vulnerable point in your life. A key thing to remember for consumers is you have rights. It doesn't mean that you don't have obligations, but you have rights. Debt collectors, for example, are not allowed to harass or abuse you. And by that, I mean they can't call late at night. They can't call early in the morning. They can't make threats. And if you experience anything like that, you should report this collector toot sweet to the Federal Trade Commission. And then on top of that, many people might not know there is a statute of limitations for many forms of debt, including credit card debt. Now, it varies from state to state, but typically it runs anywhere from 3 years to 5 years, give or take. Now, once the statute of limitations passes, that doesn't mean the debt magically goes away and you've just won a game of beat the clock. What it means is they can still keep trying to collect. They can still mess with your credit file. They just can't take you to court. They can't sue you.
We've had listeners ask us, okay, how much do I pay off? How do I do this? Let's make a game plan. Your account is in collections. What do you do?
You know, I would say you want to be as aggressive as possible. Making just the minimum payment is never a smart idea. And I would agree with that, because if you make just minimum payments, especially for a credit card debt, it just means that your debt over the long haul is going to keep growing and growing. And the amount you'll ultimately have to pay out of pocket is going to be enormous, maybe 2 to 3 times what you would have paid had you paid things regularly or in full. But if you're like most people and you're not the most liquid person in the world, what you want to do is come up with how much money can I spare and not completely devastate my life. And if you're having a hard time doing this yourself, and many people do, there is no stigma attached to that. There are credit counselors out there. And I would recommend...
For free.
Yes, for free. And I would recommend that you look for some nonprofit agency, some nonprofit group that is going to point you towards a licensed credit counselor in your neck of the woods and talk to somebody.
What if there's a mistake? Your debt went to collections, but you're like, hey, I paid this thing. Then what do you do?
What you need to do is, first of all, be patient. because these guys are going to make you jump through hoops. Second of all, be prepared to submit your case in writing to the debt collector, explaining why this debt has been paid off or why this debt isn't yours or why there's been some mistake. Make the case. And like I say, it has to be in writing. They want to have a paper trail. 9 times out of 10, especially if you're dealing with a debt buyer who's just bought the debt for pennies on the dollar and is looking to get anything, they'll walk away because you're not worth the trouble at that point.
What about if you did something a little less formal? Say you borrowed from a family member or a friend. What do you do then?
Well, now it's just all in the family. And in theory, they might be able to sue you if you're from that kind of family. On the other hand, this is just one of those reasons why you don't want to borrow money from loved ones, because ultimately it can lead to a really poisonous relationship if the money gets in the way, if you can't pay it back. So be very mindful of that. And, you know, it's like old Polonius said, neither a borrower or a lender be. Well, if somebody in the family comes to seeking some money, you might want to think twice before loaning it. I'm not saying go totally down the tough love road, but you might want to think twice.
David Lazarus is a consumer columnist for the LA Times. Thanks so much, David.
Always a pleasure.
For our next show, we want to know whether or not the Affordable Care Act has changed your life. Come tell us your story on MarketplaceWeekend.org or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. We'll be talking about it all week online, and we'll feature some of your stories in next week's show. Everybody has one, a moment or a story where money changes your life. Maybe your liquidity dried up. Maybe you opened your first bank account. This week, an actress and musician decides to teach her father a lesson about handling his cash.
I'm Alicia Witt. I'm an actor and a singer-songwriter. You might have seen me on Justified on FX this past year. I've been doing it since I was 7 years old. I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. It's about 50 miles or so west of Boston. My parents were both teachers. My dad made about $35,000 a year, and we didn't have a car until I was, I think, 11. We relied on other people to take us to the grocery store or my other grandparents to take us to piano lessons. Money was always something that we had to be careful of. Despite the fact that my father was working so hard for comparatively so little money, I couldn't believe that my dad kept all of his cash in his back pocket of his pants. He never had a wallet, and I decided to test him once and just kind of teach him a lesson in my childish way. I decided that every day, for as long as I could get away with it, I would go into my dad's bedroom and find his pants where he had thrown them on the floor or changed into another pair of pants, and I would just remove the cash from the back pocket and hide it. And I did this consistently for about 2-3 weeks. My brother and I were laughing about it and wondering at what point they would notice, because we had hundreds of dollars. I wanted to show him that he wasn't keeping track of how much cash he had on him at any given time. Then I walked through the kitchen one day, and my parents were sitting there at the kitchen table talking in hushed tones, very tensely, very upset and confused. They were saying, there's hundreds of dollars missing. I don't know where the money's going. I mean, here's our grocery list. Here's our electricity. I don't know. So my brother and I decided that was the moment to spring into action. I went into my room and took out handfuls of money and just started walking through the kitchen, fanning myself with the cash. And I would like to be able to say that it completely changed the way my dad handled his cash, but he still carries it in his back pocket.
Actress and musician Alicia Witt. Maybe you caught her on the last season of Justified. She's also performing in Los Angeles throughout August, and you can find details at aliciawittmusic.com.
And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next time, we'll have some brunch and talk about whether or not the Affordable Care Act has changed your financial life. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Jenny Ament, and John Sepulvedo. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer. Ravi Karman is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you next weekend. This is APM.